This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Coming up on Africa News Tonight:
this government needs to address these economic as well as social demands from the revolution in order to make sure the transition stays on track and the country does not go in the wrong direction.
That is Sarah Yarkes, a fellow at the Carnegie Middle East Program on the daunting economic challenges facing Tunisia's new administration. Also, Cameroon's opposition leader is arguing a boycott of elections in February. And two French military helicopters have crashed in Mali, killing 17 soldiers. And the World Health Organization has pulled out 49 staffers amid an upsurge in violence in an Ebola hotspot. We'll have those stories and more, so stay tuned. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Cameroon has warned opposition political parties against any acts that may jeopardize its local council and parliamentary elections in February. The warning comes after opposition party leader Maurice Kamto, who claims President Paul Biya stole last year's October election, called for a boycott of the polls. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon Territorial Administration Minister Paul Atanganji says the government will not tolerate any acts that disturb the free conduct of February's local and parliamentary elections.
Politicians specialize in hate speech, manipulation and provocation, as well as defiance of state authority, should know that they will face the heavy arm of the law in case of any misconduct. I want to make it very clear. Promoters of political parties will henceforth be held accountable in case of any disruption of public order related to political rallies.
This warning came after opposition leader Maurice Kamto, at a Monday press conference, announced a boycott of the February polls. Kamto had planned to run for office but changed his mind and accused authorities of trying to destroy his party, the Cameroon Renaissance Movement, CRM.
Organiser des élections au Cameroon aujourd'hui.
Kamto says he does not doubt that the objective of what he calls the illegitimate Yaoundé regime, in collaboration with the Ministry of Territorial Administration and the different state services, is to destroy the CRM party. He says they want to eliminate the party from the political map and terrorize the Cameroonian people to keep the ruling class in power. Kamto accuses Nje of scheming with Cameroon's elections management body ELECAM to fix last year's presidential election to re-elect long-serving President Paul Biya. The election authorities and Nje deny the polls were anything but free and fair. Kamto said his boycott was based on electoral laws that favor Biya's ruling party, the Cameroon's People's Democratic Movement, CPDM, and the ongoing separatist conflict. His call for an election boycott received mixed views from opposition supporters like 30-year-old Justin Alega.
Le professeur Maurice Kamto a trahi ses partisans. Je pense que le professeur est en train de plonger.
He says Kamto has betrayed his supporters and is plugging his political party into the group of losers, because when they are not represented at the National Assembly, says Alega, they will no longer have a platform for their voices to be heard. He says if Kamto wants to change Cameroon's laws, he says, are bad. He should do everything to be voted in as a lawmaker. 31-year-old Kamto supporter Annabelle Mbi, however, says he supports the decision to boycott the elections.
There is no need going for an election when you know that your victory will be stolen, and often when you protest, you are arrested. This is a dictatorship.
Political analyst at the University of Yaoundé, Divine Kwe, says the opposition MRC should fight for political change from within, as the new parliament's mandate will last 5 years.
The meaning is that for the next 5 years, MRC will only make their voices heard through street protest, because they will not participate at decision-making circles directly. Kamto should have gone in for the elections and tried to effect changes from within parliament.
Kamto called on Monday for other opposition parties, civil society and religious groups to join in boycotting the elections. Territorial Administration Minister Nje warned he would arrest Kamto or anyone else who staged unauthorized protests against the elections. Kamto and more than 400 of his supporters spent 9 months in prison for street protests over the October 2018 presidential election results. Authorities released Kamto in October for a national dialogue on the separatist conflict in Cameroon, but he was banned from holding public events. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
France says that 13 of its soldiers died when two helicopters crashed today while supporting troops fighting Islamist militants in Mali. It was the latest group of fatalities in the increasingly dangerous Sahel region and the biggest French military loss of life in 36 years. The French military says that the helicopters were reinforcements for ground troops who had been tracking a group of Islamic fighters for days. The aircraft were believed to have collided at low altitude. France, the former colonial power in Mali, has had a major military presence there since 2013 when it launched an intervention against Al-Qaeda-linked jihadists who had overrun the country's north. Since then, other Islamist militant groups, including Islamic State, have also moved into the area, along with neighboring Burkina Faso and Niger. Tunisia took another step forward in its democratic transition by electing political outsider Kais Saied in its second free presidential ballot since the 2011 revolution. Experts say that while this revived public faith in the political process, the new government faces difficult economic problems which have been alienating thousands of unemployed graduates. Sarah Yakis is a fellow at the Carnegie Middle East Program. He spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shanawi about whether Tunisia's transition can overcome the daunting economic challenges.
I think that they can, but it will certainly be up to this new parliament, the new government, to work with President Saied in order to meet these economic challenges. And to do so, this new government is going to have to take some risks that the previous parliament was not willing to, including satisfying the demands of the unions, but while also trying to deal with the bloated public sector. They're also going to have to address the issue that Saied really won on, which is the issue of corruption, and figure out both how to have a more efficient government, but also have more transparency and put more trust back into the government.
Tunisia's assigned Prime Minister Habib Jimli, who is tied to the Islamist Ennahda party, began consultations with political parties to discuss the government program and to choose ministers. He said it will be the last chance for the revolutionary process because Tunisians were patient enough and the youth are frustrated and it's time they can see hope at the end of the tunnel. What do you make of that?
I think that he's absolutely right that patience is running out, that this government needs to address these economic as well as social demands from the revolution in order to make sure the transition stays on track and the country does not go in the wrong direction. There is a lot of weight put on the shoulders of President Saied, and eventually will be also put on the shoulders of the new government once it is formed, to deliver on the things that the young people in particular really are looking for. If they aren't able to do that, if they cannot address these economic and social demands, we're likely to see further increase in people turning away from government, including what we've already seen, these trends of increase in suicides, increase in migration, radicalization, and increase in protest, rather than people turning towards the formal political system to make their voices heard. This election did deliver a presidential candidate that the youth picked themselves, that they voted for overwhelmingly, but now it's going to be up to that new government in order to deliver on the demands of the youth.
Tunisia is often considered the only Arab country to have successfully transitioned to democracy following the 2011 Arab Spring. What would it take to complete a success story in Tunisia?
Tunisia is well on its way to becoming a fully consolidated democracy, but it needs to fully implement the good changes that it put into the 2014 constitution. In particular, the judicial sector has not had many reforms put in place yet. There's still the lack of a constitutional court. So putting into place all of the recommendations from the constitution And it also includes decentralization. This is a very slow process that Tunisia has embarked on, and they really need to step up the process of decentralizing power from the central state to the municipalities, to the regions, in part so that they can really address the divide between the coast and the interior. And they need to make sure that the public really believes that democracy is irreversible in Tunisia. This is something they're not willing to turn their backs on. So far, we have seen a real commitment to democracy. Hopefully, we're going to continue to see that going forward.
Do you see any role for the international community in helping Tunisian transition to democracy?
Absolutely. I think we have sometimes come up with this idea that Tunisia is doing so well that the international community isn't necessary. That's not true. Tunisia does need help. They need the involvement of the United States, Europe, and others who have been very good about providing assistance for civil society, for democratic reforms, political party training, those sorts of things. That assistance needs to continue. We need that money to keep flowing to make sure that these new institutions, the institutions that are really just getting off the ground, have the funds and have the personnel necessary to carry out these really challenging reforms.
That was Sarah Yarkes, a fellow at the Carnegie Middle East Program. She was speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. The World Health Organization has pulled out 49 staffers fighting Ebola in Beni in the DRC after four people were killed in protests against poor security. Sporadic violence has forced other temporary shutdowns of the international effort to end the nearly 16-month-old outbreak in the eastern DRC, where a large number of rebel groups operate. Crowds defied warning shots fired by Congolese forces yesterday and stormed a UN camp which had apparently been evacuated after rioting broke out in the eastern town of Beni. The violence was prompted by the killing overnight of eight people in Beni, the latest attack blamed on the Allied Democratic Forces militia. Such attacks have hampered the Ebola fight because it's critical to track people infected by the disease and vaccinate or treat people that they come in contact with. The Zimbabwean government is coming to grips with the impact of extreme discontent with the economic downturn as members of the security forces begin to vent their frustration in what observers say is a possible harbinger of things to come. Adi Gondo gives us more on the story.
Without warning, a member of the Presidential Guard pumped 30 shots from his AK rifles into the air near State House, causing pandemonium before colleagues disarmed him as he was reloading. The soldier was quoted as complaining of his inability to survive in a nearly dead economy while men in suits are living large. Observers say the incident is not surprising given that the security forces, especially the junior ranks, are not spared from the economic meltdown in the country. Mbuso Fuzwayo, a political analyst, calls the incident a bad omen.
Because if the morale is low in the barracks, the security of the country is compromised. So I think that is a turning point that the masses are suffering, the military is suffering, the junior officers. And if they can combine forces with the civilians, those in leadership are exposed.
Defense Minister Opam Chinguri Kashiri recently appraised legislators on the dire state of the military's finances. The Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Defense and Home Affairs heard that soldiers and police officers' morale had hit rock bottom due to shortages of food and uniform. Finance Minister Mthuli Ncube 2 weeks ago announced the security sector would get a little more than 10% of the $63.8 billion 2020 budget in a move to raise morale and avert hunger and poor resourcing in the armed forces. But experts say as long as the currency is losing value amid hyperinflation, that won't be enough to address the plight of the security forces, let alone the rest of the populace. Fuzwa says the military's grievances will continue to roil.
Unfortunately, the increment that can be given, if it is in bonds, the bond does not sustain that. You can give somebody 1,000 today, tomorrow it will not be able to buy the toilet paper. So the increment, as long as our currency is losing daily value, it doesn't matter how much you give them. Because you give them money, prices are going up. So the hyperinflation is a problem.
The local RTS dollar or bond dollar currently is trading in the parallel market at 20 units to one US dollar. Cash is hard to come by despite an injection of new notes by the central bank, and soldiers get paid electronically like everyone else. Long queues at the banks to withdraw cash are normal. Some supermarkets selling basic goods tend to insist on cash. Junior soldiers' or families are just as exposed as everyone. Fuzua agrees.
Young ones, they look at their families, they've got aspirations, they need accommodation, they need food. They've got young families to look after. I don't think the leadership looks at the young ones. They always look at themselves and they don't care about these young ones who are looking after them. If there is a senior office who can take advantage of that in the middle layer, Zimbabwe might be in flames.
Fuzwa believes that despite government's mantra that international sanctions are to blame, wrong priorities lay at the heart of the economic wars.
Unfortunately, I think the issue is about our priorities as a nation. If you are to look at those who are in leadership, look at the number of cars that they are having, wherever they are driving. Now you'll realize that when the president is going out, the delegation, jet that he hires, so all those things, they are a clear sign that people might be saying, no, if the country is suffering as they are telling us, why are they spending so much?
Meanwhile, a bleak festive season looms with no hope of a reprieve as inflation erodes buying power daily. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo.
You're listening to VOA's Africa News Tonight. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Some big business women in Africa said that the continent will not achieve the development it needs unless stereotypes that underestimate women are eliminated in business society. The call came during the three-day Global Gender Summit 2019 in Kigali to tackle a $42 billion female financing gap.
Paul Oteka is a 43-year-old South African entrepreneur who co-founded the IDF Capital in Sandton in Johannesburg. The company provides financial and non-financial products and support to unlock the value of women's small and medium enterprises. She says she realized it's very difficult for an African woman to start a business without leaning on a man's shoulder, which she says keeps the continent undeveloped.
You walk into a room, people don't really think that you've got a really commercially viable opportunity to talk about. I have found that the market, for instance, assumes that women run micro-businesses that are slow-growing businesses. And
economic experts warned that if African leaders want to really nurture women, they need to fund activities that employ many of them. The African Development Bank estimates 75% of African farmers are women. The International Finance Corporation, IFC, says that of the total financing gap for women in Africa, an estimated $15.6 billion is in agriculture. Akinwumi Adesina, president of African Development Bank, FDB, assures that it is doing what it can to fill the gap.
I think when you get land in the hands of women, it can transform things. That's why the African Development Bank, we are doing quite a lot to, on agriculture. We're spending $25 billion over 10 years and making sure all we do in agriculture is directed towards empowering these women.
There is a hope that more initiatives to develop women and enhance gender equality in the business can be adopted as leaders from government, development institutions, the private sector, civil society and academia have gathered for this year's Global Gender Summit, which aims to make women's voices heard. Rwanda's President Paul Kagame says Africa needs to move from rhetoric to practice, from words to deeds.
Therefore, learn, do, change and measure so that we are able to tell where we have come from and where we are at the present and where we could be going forward in the future.
The summit, co-hosted by the FDB and Rwanda, is being held in Africa for the first time. It has attracted more than 800 participants that include heads of state, first ladies and other prominent gender activist key players. One of its objectives is to share best practices and mobilize investments to speed up gender equality and women empowerment around the globe. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Over the next 2 weeks, the world marks the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. A new report from Afrobarometer shows domestic violence remains tolerated in many African countries. The report says about one in four African women and even more African men say that men sometimes are justified in beating their wives. Mavis Okere in Washington has more.
While 71% of Africans say it is never justified for a man to beat his wife, 28%, including 24% of women, see beating as sometimes or always justified. These findings from national surveys in 34 countries are part of a Pan-African profile analysis of a survey on gender equality. The new report by the Afrobarometer Public Opinion Survey Group examine issues such as gender equality, government performance on women's rights and gender gap in education and employment. Dominic Dryden is an assistant project manager for Afrobarometer and a co-author for the report on gender. She says acceptance of violence against women is particularly widespread in Central and West Africa and among respondents with no formal education. She says in Liberia and Gabon, up to 7 in 10 citizens tolerate domestic violence. However, not more than 1 in 20 respondents in Cabo Verde, Madagascar, Eswatini, and Malawi tolerate domestic violence. She says the polling showed that 64% of Africans across the continent thought their governments were doing fairly well on promoting equal rights and opportunity for women.
But of course, this again varies dramatically across the continent. So while 86% of Ugandans think that the government is doing well, only 41% of those in Gabon, for instance, feel the same way. Overall, there's a generally positive view.
Afrobarometer survey indicates that public opinion on domestic violence may be changing in Africa. A 2005 survey by the International Perspective on Sexual and Reproductive Health in 7 nations found that 36% of women in Malawi approved of wife beating in at least some circumstances. And in Mali, 89% of women thought it could be justified. The survey was done between 1999 and 2001 in Benin, Ethiopia, Malawi, Mali, Rwanda, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. In both surveys, respondents with no formal education made up 41% were significantly more likely to endorse wife beating than those with primary, secondary, or post-secondary schooling made of 23% to 25%.
I think that really improving education systems on the continent, but also education around gender equality and domestic violence would really help shift citizens' perceptions on whether this is okay or not.
African countries are not alone in tolerating spousal abuse. A world value survey done between 2010 and 2014 shows that in 29 countries, one-third of men said it was acceptable for a husband to beat his spouse. In 19 countries, a third of women said beatings by husbands could be acceptable. The study is led by an international network of researchers based in Stockholm. It showed that about two-thirds of women in India tolerated spousal abuse, as well as large number of women in countries such as China, Iraq, Peru, the Philippines, and Uzbekistan. Afrobarometer leads a nonpartisan research network in conducting attitude surveys on democracy, governance, economic conditions, and related issues across Africa. The special model on gender equality was carried out in partnership with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Reporting for the VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Stay tuned to the sunny side of sports and tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Wackinger, and our engineer, Khalid Nashwan, I'm Jackson Bunganyi. Thank you for choosing the Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports, or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.